That's the opening music from the Second Symphony of Ludwig van Beethoven in a performance by the Philharmonia Orchestra of London, conducted by Otto Klemperer from 1959. Otto Klemperer, one of the many illustrious conductors over the years who have had a long-term relationship with the Philharmonia Orchestra. That orchestra is coming to the Krannert Center in Urbana for a concert tomorrow night, with the conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen, their present artistic advisor and principal conductor. And I'll be talking with a member of the orchestra in just a moment. Coming up later on Live and Local this afternoon, we'll have oboist John Dee, who is on the faculty at the University of Illinois School of Music. He is giving a recital on the campus in Urbana on Wednesday evening, and he'll be doing a little live playing for us on the program today and sharing some music from among his recordings. Julian Malone plays second violin in the Philharmonia Orchestra and has been with them since 1983. He's also a composer, and he was kind enough to join us on the program today to talk a bit about tomorrow night's concert. Thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I understand you got started in the orchestra right at the time that Mr. Salonen made his debut. Was it his debut with the Philharmonia or his debut in London altogether?
I think it was his debut in London altogether. It's certainly his debut with the Philharmonia. He was 25 years old at the time, so he was, which is, as you know, is very young for a conductor. Certainly it was his first time in London with a major symphony orchestra.
And he was doing a monumental piece, Mahler's Third Symphony.
He was, yes, and it was very brave, I think, for him to stand into the breach, really.
Somebody was indisposed.
Normally, it's the last thing an orchestra wants to do, or any promoter wants to do, is to change the piece of music. That's usually sacrosanct. It's whoever stands in will be asked to do that piece of music, because that's why people buy the tickets, you see. So,
you mean that they actually go for the music instead of the conductor?
In general, I would say absolutely. Yeah.
Because I think some conductors might be mortified to believe that that's true.
I think people have. I mean, of course, people have their favorite conductors, and if their favorite conductors happen to be conducting their favorite piece as well, then that's the double thing.
But all the better.
In general, that's the rule of thumb of concert giving, is that if someone pulls out, you stick with the program if at all possible.
Well, I do certainly want to talk about conductors, a little bit about Mr. Salonen, mm-hmm. but before we do that, so you've been in the orchestra since the early 80s.
Yeah, indeed.
Wanted to ask a little bit about the history of, or maybe just the overall orchestral situation in London, because I don't know if there's any other city in the world that has at least five major orchestras, which is just sort of astounding. How does that all work?
There's a very healthy respect between the orchestras. Obviously, it's a very competitive thing, and I think one of the reasons why the London orchestras are very good is by the very fact that they have this competition in the city itself. You know, you're basically as good as your last concert. So you make sure that your last concert is absolutely marvelous. And it's a big city. I mean, we're 12 million people in the area and surrounding area. So it can certainly take that amount of the musical life in London is very varied, and it's full of wonderful things.
But, of course, for example, here in the United States, New York City is humongous, and they have all of one orchestra.
That is true, yeah.
And so you really have a unique setup. I think the orchestra that the London Orchestra Americans are probably most familiar with is the London Symphony Orchestra, because they seem to get all the film gigs.
They do indeed, and traditionally they always have. There is a sort of advantage in their title. I mean, it's always felt that the Philharmonia Orchestra, because it doesn't have a sort of place name in its title, the general, I mean, not the cognoscenti obviously know absolutely where it's from, but, you know, it's always sometimes fighting on a losing wicket, you know, if you don't have your provenance in the title of your orchestra. But it's so I think for that reason, the London Symphony Orchestra is probably more associated with London. And if anyone wants an orchestra, symphonic orchestra from London, London Symphony might be the one to go for. But I think they are our healthiest sort of rivals in a way.
I think that when I think back on recordings and what I know about relationships of conductors with London orchestras, the one that seems to have the perhaps the pedigree of working with some of the best-known conductors around the world maybe is the Philharmonia. I mean, Otto Klemperer, for example, has a long relationship, and Herbert von Karajan had a long relationship.
Indeed.
Carter Muti, long one, and so on.
And Sinopoli, and then Christoph von Dohnányi, and now Isa Becker. It certainly is true that we've built the right person in charge can really build a sort of sound and a vision, but it doesn't alter the very nature of the orchestra. I always remember, actually, when Bernard Haitink came to conduct us in, must have been the late 80s, and he sort of conducted for an hour, and then he sort of stopped. He put down his baton and he said, "Let me ask you a question," he said. "Who was here when I very first conducted this orchestra in 1953, I think, or 54? And there was about, even in the late 80s, perhaps about one person, I think, in the bass section. And he said, "Well, that's amazing, because this orchestra sounds exactly the same now as it did then." And which is a wonderful thing, because that's what you hope. You know, an orchestra has a sound, a particular way of playing, and that's what happens when people join it. They assimilate that way of playing. And that's how you get this amazing consistency of sort of sound. The Philharmonia has always been renowned for its luscious, you know, good luscious string sound and very noble sort of sound. I thought it was quite sort of amazing for someone to say, you know, 30 years on, that it sounded just like it used to sound.
I've actually been reading a number of interviews with current conductors. Well, some of them not current anymore because they passed on since some of the interviews done. But one of them was with Riccardo Muti, and he was talking part of this interview about his relationship with the Philharmonia and how he went about working to change the sound, or at least to make it, to mold it to his notion of sound. And Haitink's comment suggests that maybe that doesn't happen as much as conductors think.
I think it's more in their own. I mean, Muti and Haitink do conduct in a different way, and Muti's way is quite direct and quite exciting and sort of a visceral feel, you know. And Bernard Haitink's is a much more sort of relaxed way, really. I mean, it's absolutely true what you say. And certain conductors, they like a certain sound, and they will sort of get it. But I think it's a sort of like a sort of default way. I mean, talking actually of the LSO and the Philharmonia, there's always the old thing about the London Symphony Orchestra is like, the conductors have likened it to an Italian sports car, and the Philharmonia they likened to a Rolls Royce. You know, it's that sort of, the LSO has this sort of slightly brash, slightly forward, you know, very sort of attractive sound, and the Philharmonia's got this plush, wonderful sort of leather seat sort of feel about it, which is true. I mean, it's people that come and hear them both, and they would say even now it's the same. That would be the same sort of difference.
Well, just by way of illustration for our listeners, I'm going to play right now a part of a recording, the opening of a recording that Riccardo Muti made with the Philharmonia, of Rossini's overture to his opera The Silken Ladder, La Scala di Seta. And then I'm going to sort of grossly segue into Esa-Pekka Salonen's recording done fairly recently with the Philharmonia of the second movement of one of the pieces that y'all are going to be playing at the Krannert Center tomorrow evening. And we're just going to kind of fade out of one and go into the other, and then we'll chat for a bit after that. We're talking with Julian Malone of the Philharmonia Orchestra's second violin section here on Live and Local. We just heard first part of the overture to The Silken Ladder, music by Gioachino Rossini, Riccardo Muti conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra during his tenure as principal conductor. And then we heard the opening of the second movement, The Waltz, from the Symphonie Fantastique by Hector Berlioz, also the Philharmonia Orchestra conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen, who is the current principal conductor, who will be bringing the orchestra to the Krannert Center in Urbana tomorrow night to play that piece as well as the Second Symphony of Beethoven. And I'm talking with Julian Malone of the Philharmonia Orchestra Second Violin Section. What is the role of the principal conductor of the Philharmonia? Because I notice you don't use the term music director.
It is true, and it's pretty much in a name. I mean, the principal conductor has overall, is basically charged with the standard of the orchestra, and it has by far the most amount of work with it. But it's a big thing, I think, for a conductor, because when they come as guest conductors, you know, they can, you know, prepare their programs and everything. But a principal conductor sort of digs deeper, really, and gets really, really involved, and can and also, as you were mentioning about with Riccardo Muti, having a vision of the sort of sound they want, and then being able to sort of further that by spending so much time with the orchestra.
And then what's your sense of how things are evolving under Mr. Salonen? And actually, how long has he been in this role with you?
So he's halfway through his second, I think he's probably 4 or 5 years. I think he's just about to start his second patch as he's re-signed, you know, for another 3 years. He's just starting his second patch of that. We love Esa-Pekka. His repertoire is quite eclectic. He's really good on contemporary music. That's fantastic, and you know, obviously being a composer himself, he just understands how things are put together and can bring real sort of insights into those pieces. And he's a very, very exciting conductor as well.
What makes that true?
What, the exciting?
Yeah.
Well, he's very energetic. He's sort of pocket dynamo, really. It's amazing, and he can sort of just bring the best out in an orchestra. Really, he's quite sort of florid with his gestures, but it's so right when he's on the podium.
I wonder if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about your role in the second violin section. A lot of people are familiar with the expression second fiddle without actually maybe knowing where it comes
from.
It
is a sort of slightly sort of demeaning expression, I suppose. I mean, the second violins are, also with the violas, so the sort of the meat of the orchestra. I will actually always remember I have some coaching from the Aeolian String Quartet when I was a student, a very celebrated quartet. And the leader of that said, likened a string section to a bottle of wine. And he'd say, so you have this bottle of wine. The label is the first thing you see. The label is the first violins. So that's what sort of announces its arrival. And the bottle itself is that's the cello and the bass section. That's the thing that actually carries the whole thing. But the wine itself, that's the middle of the, that's the violas and the second violins are the wine itself. And that's sort of like, I would say it's absolutely true. You know, it's the real meat of the orchestra. An orchestra would not sound if it didn't have the middle sections of the strings playing as committed and as full and with incredible commitment. It just wouldn't sound as good as it does, really.
It would be sort of like, I mean, just to sort of carry the wine analogy a little farther, if you had a wine that maybe had a nice, bright, crisp taste, but no particular body to it, and no, I'm not good at my wine terminology, and no no complexity.
Yeah, no aftertaste.
Yeah, no aftertaste to it.
Yeah, that wouldn't be so good.
Yeah. And mostly this is, well, at least in part, this is because of the harmony in that the middle voices and the strings
also,
fill that out.
It's sort of a curious, it's a curious thing because good middle strings, good second violins are quite happy to play the harmony. You know, they're not, and that's why they meld, sometimes they meld very well as sections, and the first violins are full of, shall we say, occasionally, can be full of prima donnas that want to just sort of strut their stuff. Second violin sections are nearly always full of people that are just really, you know, happy to play the music and, you know, play those underneath parts which are so important, you know.
And sort of melding our conversation on this topic and the role of the conductor, how do you, as a player, in whichever part of the second violin section you may be sitting in for a given concert, and I assume you rotate positions.
We do rotate, yeah.
How do you balance the listening to each other, watching what's on the page, and figuring out what the conductor is suggesting that you do?
Yeah, it is an amazing thing that though you have to do all those three things, sort of all at once sometimes, and that's the sort of that's where the experience comes in. I think we you know alluded to before to the amount of orchestras in London. In Britain, we play in orchestras from virtually from when we start playing our instruments, and everyone that grows up in British musical life is very attuned to playing in an orchestra, and it's been used to listening to their colleagues sort of all the way through. Which is, you know, that's one of the reasons why the British orchestras actually are sort of celebrated, really. There's this amazing sort of corporate feeling that everybody's listening to everybody else. And then, of course, you're playing your part and you are watching your conductor. But the listening to each other is still sort of ingrained from so young that it's almost like second nature, really.
Well, we're going to go out with a little bit of the final movement of Hector Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. That piece will be the second half, the second two-thirds, really, second and third-thirds of the concert tomorrow night by the Philharmonia Orchestra from London. Will be conducted by their principal conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen. First up on the program is the Second Symphony of Beethoven. And it's been my pleasure to talk with a member of the second violin section of the Philharmonia Orchestra, Julian Malone. Thanks very much for joining us. Travel safely, and looking forward to the concert.
Thank you very much.
From a live recording of the final movement of the Symphonie Fantastique by Hector Berlioz, the Philharmonia Orchestra of London, conducted by its principal conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen. They will be playing that complete work at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts to kick off their U.S. tour tomorrow night at 7:30. And Krannert Center is in Urbana on the University of Illinois campus. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our broadcast today is made possible by these business partners: Swire's Land and Management Company of Danville, EAG Company Incorporated of Fairmount, Cannon Farms of Camargo. These business partners join the friends of WYLL in making great programs possible, and we thank you very much. Next on our program, we have one of the members of the School of Music woodwind faculty at the University of Illinois, based in Urbana-Champaign. His name is John Dee. He's professor of oboe, the one and only professor of oboe. There's one professor per woodwind instrument, flute, oboe, clarinet, and bassoon. Not quite the same thing for brass. There's an extra trumpet professor, and some other string professors, and so on. And he's pointing this out. He's officially the Bill A. Nugent Endowed Professor of Music Performance. That must mean something. John Dee is going to be giving a recital Wednesday evening at 7:30 at Smith Music Hall on the University of Illinois campus, along with pianist Kara Chowning, who is also joining us live, and we'll be hearing from both in just a moment, and also some string instrumentalists, Maureen Murchie violin, Kim Uwate on viola, and Ben Hayek on cello, and it's a nice program that they've put together. John and Kara, thanks for coming in, joining us on the show.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks.
The oboe, I have heard referred to as the concertmaster of the woodwind, or of the whole wind section, in addition to the concertmaster of the whole orchestra, which is, of course, the first violinist. Is that a fair term, and if so, what does that mean for orchestral players?
Well, I think that while each of the principal voices play extensive solos and can be considered in their own right, in a sense, concertmasters, the oboe has the, I think, for the public's sake, the oboe has the principal role of tuning the orchestra, which is sort of associated with the concertmaster to begin with. As we know, when the concert starts and the concertmaster comes out and the lights go down and points to the oboe is responsible for giving a good A and to the orchestra, a good tuning note. And so I think that begins the connection. I think it'd be fair to say that the oboe is certainly one of, if not the lead solo instrument in the orchestral repertoire. Just the amount of solos and sort of where those solos are done throughout the repertoire. So it's a very busy instrument. I think the vocal element is there when it comes to not only the double reed that we use and the vocal cords and the similarity, but also the range of the instrument that fulfills a very beautiful place in the register where flutes are very beautiful, but perhaps even higher and serve even a higher soprano voice, and the clarinet's a little lower, all very, very unique, and they all have their place. But the oboe seems to get just really beautiful, delicious solos throughout the repertoire. So I think the name or association with concertmaster has a truth to it.
What's the reason that the orchestra tunes to an oboe?
Well, I think the number, I don't know how long ago studies were done, but studies have been done on, in terms of overtones and frequencies, and the oboe has a rather pure tonality, and the way the frequencies, the true tone of it is a less complicated type of sound than many other sounds that are put into recording devices. In addition, so therefore, it also projects very well. The oboe is a projecting instrument. Again, partially range. Also, may have something to do with the double reed in its in the physics involved. But the oboe again is placed in the middle of the orchestra, so everyone can hear the instrument from where it sits in the orchestra as well. So I think those are some of the reasons that are. That we're turned to for tuning. I know I've spent an awful lot of money on tuners and a lot of time making reeds myself from hand, by hand to be sure that the A's are good and reliable. And we, you know, orchestras have tuning notes that are written in the contract. Your A will be 440, which is the frequency, or 442. Most orchestras are either 440 or 442. I know with the Florida Philharmonic, we used to tune consistently at 441. I haven't had a license plate that said A441.
Oh, nice.
But,
and that means the number of cycles per second.
Yes, exactly.
That the pitch
actually
vibrates.
So we have tuning machines, and we started with tuning forks back in the day in youth orchestra. I'm not sure. I know you do a lot with the youth orchestra, and if they're using...
They use tuners, definitely.
Yeah.
So in the days of the tuning fork, people had to trust you as the oboist, that your ear was right on. Now you just trust the tuner and
correct.
Hope that it's right on.
Well, at the School of Music, we really encourage all of our students of all the different instruments not only to have a tuner to play into, but for that tuner to play out as well. So you can use it as a training tool. It's not just listening to you, but also to play a drone and to play with it as if you have an accompanist with you. And I think that way you can constantly be training your ear. And not getting lazy. So we really work hard at keeping ear training as a priority at the School of Music at the University of Illinois.
Before we get into some live playing, one other technical question for you because you've already made reference to it, and of course it's one of the terminologies that I suspect is unclear or if not completely unknown to many of our listeners, and that is the notion of the double reed. People may know that a clarinet and a saxophone use a reed that vibrates to make the sound, and then the oboe, English horn, and bassoon have this thing called the double reed. What does that mean?
Well, really, the single reed, as we can relate, as you said, to the clarinet saxophone, they use a reed that is of the same material. It's called a rhododonax. It comes from France primarily.
What is that? I've never even heard that term.
It's a scientific term for the type of wood, which is a form of cane, a form of bamboo. But it actually, so it grows in large tubes from 8 to 15 feet long, and it grows much like wine in France. I mean, and they chop it down and have to turn it in the sun for several months and let it dry, and then they cut it to workable sizes and send it out. But the wood for the oboe and the English horn and the bassoon is slightly, so it is for the clarinet and sax also, but when the wood is processed, they become a flat reed that's placed against a mouthpiece. In the case of the oboe and English horn and bassoon, the cane is curved more. It's a much smaller tube, about a centimeter across or diameter. We split that tube, and I teach my students at the University of Illinois to make their reeds from scratch, so they're learning the whole process. And when you finally process the cane down and fold it in half and tie it onto a tube that goes into the top of the oboe and cut open the end, you get two pieces of cane that are tied together. And when shaved down with our razor knives to a specific degree, so they vibrate and play in tune and with good tone, you have these two reeds, which have to be slightly moistened, vibrate against each other, create the vibrations that go down through the oboe, and finally set the physics in motion for the sound of the instrument. Other instruments, for example, the brass, create that buzz or that vibration with their lips, as you well know as a French horn player. But the oboe uses the cane, the two pieces of blades, and much like, again, vocal cords tend to vibrate when we send air past them.
So the sound of an individual oboist is very heavily dependent on how they make their particular reeds.
It really is, and we can adjust that. Of course, as well as with other instruments, with your embouchure, the way you hold your mouth around the reed, how much reed you put in the mouth or choose to put in the mouth, your dental structure, which varies from person to person. So sound will take on individual characteristics for all musicians. The reed can also be a factor to that and extend that personality by the way you shave it and how you build. We have things and parts of the reed that we build in called the tip, the heart, the roof line, the chimney, the windows, the spine, the side, the back. And through all these different measurements and symmetries that we build in with our knife, using a bright light to look through and a piece of metal that we put between the blades to check its thickness. We even use micrometers in building reeds so that we can really keep tabs on the thicknesses involved. But through these changing these variables slightly, we get different responses, different intonation, good in the high register, low register, and it creates your individual voice. So that is a critical part of being an oboist and really takes it an extra step further than I think a lot of other instruments have the ability of going. For me, it was always a challenge to build. I've always enjoyed using my hands, building model planes and cars when I was young, and it seemed like a natural progression to continue using and having a craft as well as a art. So they say it's a science and an art all in one.
I've heard that some oboists, even though they may well know how to make perfectly good reeds themselves, will nonetheless prefer someone else's reed.
That can happen. I wish I was in that position, Kevin. I have tried. They do make them in the stores. Good reeds are generally $20 or more, 20 to 30, let's say. And that's a lot of money to spend on one reed, because what the public may not know is that a reed will vibrate and then stop vibrating or vibrate differently after hours of use. So a oboe reed is thought to perhaps have maybe 24 hours of good vibrating in it. Mm. What you figure, you practice 3 hours a day, or you have a concert at night for 2.5, 3 hours. within about a week, you're done with that read. So you have to move on to another read or one that's coming along that you've worked in and that you're breaking in. So it's a constant project that we're always working on our reads and always concerned that the read will function well for that night. They also open and close with the weather. If it's more humid, the little opening we blow through is only as large as the eye of a large needle. And when it gets, when the rain is coming, the opening will it'll open up more. And when it's drying out, it'll close. And it makes a big difference as to how you spin your air. Air is the biggest element of course, a wind instrument. The support of the wind, the way you, which you blow, how you work your musculature, that your how you do your vibrato, it's all so important. It's a big part of the reed of playing, and a lot because of the reed and how much air it will or will not take.
I'm talking with oboist John Dee of the University of Illinois School of Music. He's giving a faculty recital on Wednesday night at 7:30 at Smith Music Hall on campus with pianist Kara Chowning and some other colleagues. Kara and John both are with us live in the studio. It's an interesting program. It has music by Mozart, which is the one familiar composer to most people, I imagine. There's a new piece written for John by a local composer named Peter Michailov. In fact, this will be the world premiere performance. And then there's also this music by a fellow named Bill Douglas that was written between 1998-2011. And I think you have those pieces to play for us today.
We do. We have three of them. Actually, it comes from a collection of eight that were originally written for piano and clarinet for Stoltzmann, who he's collaborated with extensively in his career.
And Stoltzmann is Richard Stoltzmann.
Richard Stoltzmann, yeah, the clarinet soloist. And so I always like to encourage my students, and I like to think in terms of a programming of recital, something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. Well, I've got something old in the sense that I've got the Richardson pieces and the Michael Head pieces, which I actually had recorded a number of years ago, and the recording was lost by, well, unfortunately, by the death of the producer. But long story short, I'm so happy to bring the Richardson and the Head back out onto the stage. So that's something old. Something borrowed would be the Bill Douglas three pieces that we've chosen to do that we'll be doing now live in the studio.
Borrowed from the clarinet repertoire.
Yeah. So we borrowed it and we look forward to doing it because they're fresh and they're fun.
John Dee and Kara Chowning, live on Live and Local, music by Bill Douglas, three of his lyrical pieces.
Thank you.
That's music by Bill Douglas, three of his lyrical pieces, originally for clarinet, here transcribed for the oboe. And we heard, I think I remember the order, The Hills of Glencar, Return to Inishmore, and Begin Sweet World. Played here by oboist John Dee and pianist Kara Chowning. Kara on the Yamaha Clavinova, our substitute for a Steinway. In our studio here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. John and Kara will be performing in recital Wednesday night at 7:30 in the Recital Hall at Smith Music Hall on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana, and they have some other colleagues joining them for some music by Mozart, which we'll hear a bit of at the end of the program. This is Live and Local. Our broadcast today is made possible by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner. John, I'm always, I'm interested anyway in some of these technical questions that I kept asking you, and I am assuming, and I hope I'm right, that some of our listeners are too, because, you know, you see in an orchestra most often, of course you're going to be in recital, these instruments that you hear more of. I mean, somebody in orchestra concert will hear the oboe. They may see the face of the oboist or not. They may not really see the instrument, and then they'll sometimes hear sort of extraneous noises that go on. Like right before your third movement, you actually blew into the oboe and made just a blowing air sound. What was that about?
Absolutely. I hope I didn't scare anybody there, Kevin. But the oboe is a unique instrument in the sense that it's one of the conical bore instruments. So
that's
the
conical with an N, not comical with an M.
Exactly right. So it starts out with the reed, like I had mentioned, the very start of the oboe's functioning physics is that the opening of the reed is as large as the large eye of a needle. And then it progressively, in the very top of the bore of the instrument is about 3 millimeters of a circular opening that the reed goes in and attaches to. And then it grows conically down to the bells. And the bell is probably about, an inch and a half to 2 inches at its widest opening. So it's a very slow progression. What that means is, ultimately, by comparison to for example, the flute or clarinet, where the fingerings there are much more systematic or in line. The oboe, because of the conical board through the years, they had to develop a fingering system that somehow would allow for the notes to function, but a lot of forked fingerings, split fingerings, keys that had to attach one piece of metal pushes up on another and makes a pad go up, 5 inches away from where you're pressing. And what we have is a lot of because of the small bore in the top joint, a lot of very small holes that air has to pass through. The upper pad that I blew out from underneath was called an octave well, and that hole is as large as just a pin. A very small pin is all that will fit into that hole. And consequently, occasionally when the studio is a little cooler, for example, then this must be 70 degrees in here or so, and the air I'm blowing through the instrument is 90 plus. And what happens is we get a little condensation that will drift and go up into these small keys when there's a change of temperature. And we have to remove it or the sound won't come out of the oboe. And that's just one of the crosses we bear in Oboeville. And we have little pieces of cigarette paper, occasionally a judicious puff of air will be enough to dislodge the water and to clear the hole so the air can pass through without gurgling. So that sometimes just has to happen, and you just hope to do it in a way that is inconspicuous to the audience.
And sometimes not so much.
And I've
seen clarinetists do this, too.
Yeah.
We all do have it. Saxophone is not so much because the hole is a whole lot bigger.
Bigger, yeah. No, all instruments, I don't mean to make it sound mutually or exclusive to the oboe. A lot of the wind instruments have that situation that will occur from time to time. But I don't think any of the instruments have such small, fragile openings as the oboe that just get clogged up a lot easier and more quickly than others. Yes.
I have this cup that came from Starbucks, one of those travel mugs, and has a little hole in the top, you know, that allows it to drain. And the same thing happens to it. Slight, and so I'm always blowing out this thing in order to drink. But it's the same principle, I suppose. As I said earlier, your program on Wednesday night has a nice mix of music, most of which will be unfamiliar to most listeners. You have some recordings out, and I wanted to sample one of them. This is a piece that people may know if they're familiar with the oboe literature, and it's like so much of Francis Poulenc's music, it is often very lively, sometimes a little comical with an M. And I thought I'd play your recording of the scherzo, the second movement from the Sonata for Oboe by Francis Poulenc. This is oboist John Dee with pianist Carlo Grante. This is from, I guess, the late 90s.
Yes, when I was down in Miami. We actually met in Italy doing concerts, I was doing concerts there. And we were both matched as soloists with a string orchestra, I Solisti Aquilani. And at that time, he had a contract that he wanted with the company, with the record company. And he enjoyed my playing enough. I was very fortunate that he contacted the company and said, I want to work with this gentleman. And that was the beginning of that record.
Here's a little bit of music by Francis Poulenc featuring oboist John Dee, who will be in recital Wednesday night on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. That's from the Sonata for Oboe by Francis Poulenc with John Dee, the oboist and pianist Carlo Grante here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. John, with pianist Kara Chowning, will be giving recital Wednesday night. And joining them will be three string players, violinist Maureen Murchie, violist Kim Uwate, and cellist Ben Hayek, for the piece that is best known from the program. This is a piece I love to hear anytime. It's the Oboe Quartet. Well, called the Oboe Quartet, is really Quartet for Oboe and Three String Players by Mozart.
Well, Mozart himself considered this quartet to be one of his favorite works, so we're happy about that.
Well, yeah. Unlike, he was sort of famously said that he hated the flute, I think.
Right.
Which, but even though he wrote some nice, very nice music for that.
Sure.
For that as well. John and Kara, thanks very much for joining us on the show. The time has passed very quickly. I have lots more technical questions I'd love to ask, and then all kinds of other questions we'll just have to save for the next time.
It's a deal.
Thanks for coming on. Our broadcast today is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's musical heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring new exhibits entitled America's Musical Past, Shenanigans, Hootenannies, and Other Twisted Adventures. More information is available at sousaarchives.org. WYNL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois, and we're 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana, with Translator, W293 AF Danville, NPR, Classical Music, and more for Central Illinois. And here is just the opening of that oboe quartet by Mozart. It's from a recording that John made himself with members of the Tantalon Ensemble on the Clavier label. Music by Mozart on Live and Local.